Okay, well, welcome back to
Welcome.
we've crawled out of the crypt. Andrew Lugosi, the Oscar Bait podcast is opening its coffin and we're coming out as the spookiest, scariest, bloodiest, most disgusting podcast. We love horror here. We can't get enough of talking about how much we love horror. We're pivoting to a successful model finally.
No more Jess Franco, only Terrifier. You heard it here first.
1, 2, and 3. And we're gonna break them all down for you on an upcoming. We're gonna rank Arts Kill.
That's right.
I haven't seen any of those Terrifier movies because I'm not fucking 12 years old. Have you seen any of them?
I spent time with one and I feel good. Like, I get it.
Yeah, you're right. I would say unless you accidentally stumble into immortality and you truly watch everything else you've ever wanted to on Earth, and I wouldn't worry about it. You'll be all right.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, after you've spun 5 or 6 of the lesser Jess movies at least 2 or 3 times, there will be the Terrifier series waiting for everyone.
Speaking of Jess, and you can introduce me in a sec, that's fine. But speaking of Jess, when I was last on your show to talk about Jess Franco, had that happened before or after you showed Sadomania in a theater? Because
it was
before. I wanted to compliment you on that gesture. I respect that so much. I love Sadomania. I think every sensible person loves Sadomania, and I just really respect that.
We appreciate that because let's say that was a hot night at the theater for some people.
It caused the birth of a small offshoot of Trustfall, which was called Trustfall After Dark for the more adventurous viewer.
People who want their little gentrified genre movies, people who are going and they're like, ooh, I wonder if it's going to be Phantom of the Paradise. Ooh, maybe they'll show RoboCop, you know. Those people, get out of town. That's what I say.
That's right. Because you all know in the city where you can find those. Because the second we did Trustfall, suddenly little secret movie things started popping up. But that's fine. We keep it real over there. We show you Sadomania and we test the limits of people's relationships.
And there was a breakup because of this.
There was a breakup. Well, yeah. Honestly, you probably did them a favor because if there was a disagreement over Sadomania, probably it wouldn't have lasted. I don't know.
Yeah, it's true.
I say that having of course never watched Sadomania with my own partner, who I'm sure probably would not like it. You know, I think 99.9% positive she probably wouldn't like it. So
something about the animal assault was maybe a little too much.
Yeah.
But hey, nothing. It couldn't look any faker. I think the funny part is we had so much hate mail after we maybe had a 20-minute like intro being like, okay, you want to sit through this.
Yeah, because like for better or for worse, historically, we have never given warnings, right, for the movies that we show. We talk about the movies and place them in their context, but we've never given direct warnings. But for that one, us and also Willow and Caden, everybody said over and over, if you like trigger warnings, all of them apply. if you don't like, you know, debaucherous cinema, don't watch this. But people didn't listen, so it's okay. Yeah.
After you, me, and Caden tried, then there was a long video from Willow. It's like, I think all of it, we've covered all the bases, but hey. I guess not. But the best part about all that was that guy, after he his life fell apart romantically in the lobby, he George Costanza'd and just walked back in.
Yep.
Yes. Yes. I love it.
What a legend. So if you're listening out there, we owe you a free Trustfall ticket.
Yeah, that's true.
Can't replace that hole in your heart, but... yeah. But we have Will Sloan back and we got a new fish to fry this episode. Another controversial DIY filmmaker, but really the king of all the outsider filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And Will, you just wrote a book on this man, Mr. Ed Wood.
Yes, and thank you for having me on as part of my promotional efforts. I saw what's great about this, and I truly love this, is podcasts that I've been on. My publicists are reaching out to, and I first, I love saying that I have a publicist. That's great.
Cool. Yeah.
and now I love, you know, playing the kind of big shot maneuver with, you know, again, people who I have interacted with, people who have had me on their shows. I just love it so much. So thank you. A genuine honor. Thank you for having me on for this, self-indulgent book tour.
You are so welcome. You are so welcome. And we know where your position is now in the world. So when you get to Chicago, there'll be whatever you need on that backstage cart. Let us know.
Nice.
Yes, but we'll tease that out in a little bit. But let's talk the book. I got to say, I loved it. I guess I wouldn't tell you I hated it, but I really...
Thank you.
I have to say, it was nice to read a book that is focused on the aesthetic qualities of the movies rather than just simply running through the old, like, oh, it's cheap, there's a string. You know, you mentioned those things, but you found a much more interesting path to talk about a filmmaker that, and we can get into why his reputation is quote unquote the worst filmmaker ever, but you went a long way to actually like make a case that this is a lot of this is truly art.
Well, thank you. And I mean, as to the aesthetic qualities, that was one of my motivations for wanting to write the book. I felt that justice hadn't quite been paid to the strange and probably accidental beauty that some of these movies have. You know, I had a sort of epiphany watching Plan 9 from Outer Space one time that, like, this set is fake, but when you're in it, it's hard to remember what real feels like. And I think there's something to that.
He does represent a special kind of flavor in cinema, which really can only come about when there's very little money involved. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen this all across the board. I mean, we all love Jess Franco. Usually when he has less money, he is cooking. I think we, you know, certain other, you know, Andy Milligan, all these acolytes, you could say, that could come out of the universe that he created kind of on accident. It really is a sort of like, because it's like we all probably love the Universal monster movies. We love all those. But the sickos know to look in the PRC files and the Republic files.
Oh, yes.
Because there's a different flavor there. There is a more dreamlike flavor.
And, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because the early 1930s Universal horror movies like Black Cat, Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula, peerless, obviously. When you get to the 1940s and it's the sort of B Universal horror movies like, well, the second Black Cat, or I don't know, what are some of those I don't know, Ghost Island. Of Frankenstein. Yeah. Yeah, Horror Island. Those ones that Bela Lugosi's in and he plays a butler or something. Yes. And it'll be like starring Lionel Atwill. I like those movies well enough. And they're beautifully shot. You know, they have all the beautiful, like, full backing of a studio, even though they're B movies. But yeah, I prefer the PRC ones to those, even though by all objective standards, they're not as good. Just because, yeah, they do have that kind of strange, otherworldly quality to them, you know?
Yeah, they do inhabit a bit of a nightmare space, I think, in terms of, like, it usually, I feel like, has to do with the sets, the locations. Maybe they can't turn the camera too much. They can only really show one wall. Sometimes that works. And I think a good example I've always found with Ed Wood is in Night of the Ghouls. The scene that is, you know, it's going to be shocking for a lot of people, but there's genuine suspense in the scene where the character's going back up and up those spiral staircases, and he finds the mannequin woman in the closet, and it's moments like those that you, once you're bitten by stuff like that, you kind of are always seeking that sort of thing.
That actually is kind of a great scene. And I'm glad you point out that there's suspense in that scene, because Edward's reputation as the worst director of all time sort of flattened everything he did so much that it's hard for people to give him credit for the moments when he was actually kind of okay. Like, as a, he was a professional writer in his life. And while none of his books are going to get a Library of America edition anytime soon, like, there was a talent there, you know. He could spin a yarn, you know. There's a joy of storytelling in a lot of his books. And yeah, in certain movies, I don't know, the movies themselves may not fully hang together, but there are a lot of like powerful shots in them. That shot in Night of the Ghouls is one, you know, Vampira with her arms outstretched coming towards the camera in Plan 9, Tor Johnson coming out of the grave. Yeah, just iconic images between all the bad images.
Well, I love one of the things you highlight too early on in the book that you talk about. It's going to frame the way how you kind of go through it, is the importance of Edward failing on his own terms, and why that's so special to this kind of artist that we're talking about. A lot of the people that John mentioned, and even the, you know, the PRC films, it's not, these are not people that, you know, the movie didn't quote unquote fall apart because of studio interference or because of whatever it was. This is how he wanted to make these films, you know, and then that's, I think that's where that hypnosis comes in once you're hooked into it really goes. And I love that that's how you start this book, because that kind of immediately throws out, I think, how most people and most other writing on Ed Wood comes at this, as you're saying, like, yes, these movies, technically, if we're trying to, you know, do that dance, do fail often, but they fail in a very specific, authorial way.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. There's an actor, Gregory Walcott, who stars in Plan 9 from Outer Space, who gave a lot of interviews about Ed Wood over the years. And one of the things he said was he was a really charming man, but he was a con man. And he said that because he was a member of the church of the Baptist Church of Beverly Hills that paid for Plan 9 from Outer Space. So fair enough. You know, he did kind of bilk those Baptists out of their money, but also he himself made $0 from that movie. Yeah. He lost a lot of money on that movie. So he made $0 on any movie. So like, you know, you compare him to certain of the Poverty Road directors, like a William Bodine, say, who I love, to be clear. Yeah, absolutely. But it's like, you know, he wasn't that kind of director, and he was, to the extent that he was a con man for art, not for money. Yep.
For the love of the game is the Edward motto. And I do think that what you're bringing up with like William Bodine, people like, you know, honestly, like, I mean, Bodine's great. I love Frank Wisbar. I love Strangled Swamp, Devil Bat's Daughter. I'd argue Edward's probably a better director than Sam Newfield. Like,
yeah. So that, man, that's a really interesting point, because one then finds oneself getting into questions of what is a director? What does a director do? So like Sam Newfield was obviously great at making his days, at, you know, probably all of the sort of soft skills and many of the technical skills that one has to master to be a director. As much as I enjoy certain of Sam Newfield's movies, do any of them have images like the ones you see in Plan 9? And certainly they do not have like the passion of Glenn or Glenda or any of these films.
I mean, the Monster Maker's got Lionel Atwill in there, and it's like, all right.
I do like that one. I do like the monster. Yeah.
I like them all, really. I mean, I can watch.
Look, the goal is to see every Sam Newfield movie before you die.
That's
and,
right.
And then only then will you be able to do a fair and objective analysis of it. And, you know, we're going to get there.
Listen, we cut our way through Bodine, Yarbrough. It's always those kinds of movies that I've always kind of felt the genesis of Ed Wood, because I'm sure he saw those movies. You know, he was watching King of the Zombies, like, absolutely. Oh, yeah. So, okay, putting his passion aside for a second, you explain this in the book, but could you just kind of explain your what you know based off history and your own opinions on why do you think he literally became known as the worst director of all time?
Well, even though we all understand that Plan 9 from Outer Space isn't the worst movie of all time, I do think that if you were a boomer child in the 1960s watching movies on TV, it probably felt like the worst movie of all time because that movie played, especially in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, which is where, you know, a lot of the people who voted in the Golden Turkey Awards in the Medved Brothers poll, a lot of them were there. You know, they probably that movie was on TV all the time. And there are certain things in that movie, you know, the flying saucers, the tombstones, everything that probably just, you know, a level of professionalism that was a little bit below the median or substantially below at times the median Poverty Row horror film. So it probably like stuck out really intensely. And the presence of Bela Lugosi can't be underestimated in his reputation, because that's why those movies were on TV so much, because Lugosi was in them. And they played in theaters, you know, in grindhouses and drive-ins for a long time, like when somebody needed the third movie on the bill, or, you know, somebody needed a slot filler. I mean, most of them, like the chain of ownership of them would have been like, you know, it would have fallen apart. They were released by companies that went out of business. Ed Wood would have sold off all his rights. So, you know, they were just very accessible, cheap slot fillers. It is fun to read some of the books that were coming out about Bela Lugosi in the 70s, because by that point, the boomers were starting to, you know, grow up, and they were starting to write and read books about these movies that they watched on TV as kids. And it's interesting to read those books, some of which Wood himself was interviewed for, because it comes at this brief window before he was the worst director of all time, and when he was just a bad director, you know? But yeah, I think apparently just over the years and without social media, somehow word spread among the monster kids, among the boomers who watch these movies, like, oh, you got to watch this one. This Plan 9 is the worst one ever. And also, if you were a monster kid who loved Lugosi and you started to hear about, wait, what's Glenn or Glenda? Like, Bela Lugosi was in a movie about like cross dressers. What? So yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. And I guess the last thing I'll say on this is it is amazing that, so according to the Medveds, it was their readers. They published a book called The 50 Worst Films of All Time in 1978, which did not include Plan 9 from Outer Space. And I've talked to Harry Medved about this. Apparently, all of his friends, all of the people he knew were like, how could you not include Plan 9 from Outer Space in this book? And the last page of that book had a ballot that said, send in your picks for the worst movie of all time and we'll print the results in, you know, the paperback or whatever. And they got so many responses that they made a whole second book, the Golden Turkey Awards. And it was their readers who voted Plan 9 from Outer Space, which narrowly beat Exorcist 2, The Heretic, which was like the flop of the day. So okay. It was kind of amazing that it beat that movie, because that movie was a huge movie that everyone hated at the time.
Wow. Still hate.
But Plan 9 had just been simmering in people's brains, and and all those TV airings added up.
So like truly a grassroots hate campaign.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. See, that's so much more interesting than like the canon telling you. I mean, I guess it's its own canon, but it is, if it, you know, it doesn't, it's not like the writer set out, I have a mission to just say this is the worst movie. Clearly, it's like the readers voted it in.
And, you know, the Tim Burton movie, obviously, I mean, the gesture that the Medveds did in sort of proclaiming it the worst movie of all time and proclaiming him the worst director of all time. I mean, I have a lot of gratitude for the Medveds because to do that gambit or that first pronouncement is basically what everybody has been responding to ever since. And I don't think we would have the Tim Burton movie without that. Ed Wood might be known, but you know, I don't think, again, there would be no Tim Burton biopic, he might be known about as well as Ray Dennis Steckler is, sure. If that didn't happen. I don't know, just to kind of put the scale on what his fame might be.
So you're telling me right now there'd be a Severin box set coming out entirety of Ed Wood.
You know, possibly there would be, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Because if I think about how I came to Ed Wood, it's kind of what you were saying, but in obviously a different era in the 90s, because I grew up a big Universal Monster guy, and I think the 90s did a lot to help put that in kids' faces, because suddenly the monsters were on Pepsi and Doritos. And
Burger King had toys. Do you remember that?
I did. Yeah. They had them for that show, the Rick Moranis Kid Monster Show.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck. Oh,
I can't remember.
Oh, my God. Graves
Dead High.
Yes.
Wow.
Holy shit, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember like the VHS tapes were everywhere of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein in those movies, kind of in the mid to late 90s. Yeah. I mean, they were very, I rented them all. They were very accessible.
Oh, I remember the most, you know, I remember a lot of images from my life. I forget most, but I will remember the Suncoast video of set display of every one of the Universal titles. And you're like, I don't even know when I'm going to get to the monster and the girl, but you know, God's.
We need to go back because today's kids, they don't know about this, and we need to get them to the point of frenzy where they're like, oh, the Spanish version of Dracula, what's this?
Yes,
the night monster.
Yeah.
Those legs. Yeah. I mean,
what's Captive Wild Women? What's
oh, that one. My God. That truly is. Godspeed to any kid that comes across, especially those mummy sequels, and it's like, can't wait to dive. Oh, you're gonna recycle about the, you know, half of the last one in this. So there's almost where I would say is the divide for me, because like I was seeing those movies, but then I remember going to my local video store and seeing the box for Plan 9, and I was horrifically like confused because it was clearly Bela Lugosi as Dracula on the front, and I think it was the scene in Abbott and Costello where he's in the wax museum and he comes out
and it's him in the coffin. I know that cover.
Yeah.
Because for sure.
And I just remember thinking, like, what the fuck is this? Like, is it Dracula? It's something about outer space. And I really saw it for the first time without any real knowing of who Ed Wood was, and just kind of appreciated it like a child. And then eventually you start reading and you're like, oh, this guy's bad. You know, it was kind of even confusing for me because it was like, I guess it's hokey, but like, have you seen these mummy movies? Like,
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I know that when the Tim Burton movie came out, Burton would say in interviews that, you know, he saw Plan 9 from Outer Space on TV as a kid, and he didn't really relate to it as a bad movie per se. He thought it was sort of a strange movie. I know Rudolph Gray, who wrote the great biography of Ed Wood, Nightmare of Ecstasy, also felt the same way. So, I lost my train of thought, but I think that's a good and valid reaction.
There's a lot, I think, is, you know, like if you're a kid and you see this stuff and you're not thinking about, because I guess at that time, Mystery Science Theater is becoming a thing. It's like it's become pretty commonplace to laugh at a bad movie in society, you know, maybe on a bigger level. And I think when you see that shit as a kid, yeah, you're not really tapped into that. So you're responding to it in a completely different way. I found the images haunting. And then of course I see the Ed Wood movie and then I'm like, that was so, what a stupid movie. You know, when you're like, oh, and you're like, God, you're right. That isn't very good. And then you come back.
Yeah.
Like, actually, this is pretty damn good.
Yep.
I mentioned that I was grateful to the Medveds for sort of putting Ed Wood on the map that way. And I am. But what I will say that like the worst director reputation did certain of his other movies no favors, because like after especially after the Tim Burton movie, these movies would get re-released on VHS or later DVD, and they'd have the banner of like the world's worst film collection, you know, come see all these terrible movies, and it'll be like Jailbait. And people are going into that movie all primed to be like, okay, let's see the tombstones fall over. And it like doesn't deliver on that laugh a minute level, like Plan 9 from Outer Space does. And I do think that is kind of one of my motivations for this book, because I find a lot of beauty and strangeness in those movies. And I want to make people appreciate certain of those other movies.
Well, Jailbeat especially, I think that's one of the most interesting, if not strongest of the run. And it's worked. I've gotten multiple people who were very skeptical about doing this with Jailbeat. I got them in, and then you hit them with Glenn or Glenda right after, and then they've joined the army. And
yes,
it works. But I just wanted to ask about, because you brought up the biography. There's not a shortage of writing on Ed Wood, right? Mm-hmm. But you, I think, have pulled off something that, I won't talk shit, I'm trying to be a nicer person, but I would say most film books that come out these days do not do their research as far as making sure they're presenting something that's worthwhile and hasn't been tread over a million times already. And the way that you have been able to synthesize all the books that did exist that you clearly ingested, but still came out with something that I think is very unique and does offer a fresh perspective. Was there a point where that was too overwhelming, where you nearly got crushed under it? Or did you always kind of have this way in that you knew how you wanted to do it?
Well, I'm very gratified that you think I did that, because I was certainly conscious of the fact that, you know, a lot has been said about Ed Wood. I felt, when I first started noodling around with it, I basically thought, if you play one of these movies, I can talk all the way through it. So I thought, well, what if I just try this as a writing exercise to do a book, kind of like, you know, a monograph, like they would write about David Lynch, but for Ed Wood. But I also felt there was a sort of need to update the critical consensus on his work, because I think you're right that there's one of the things the book is attempting to do is synthesize a lot of developments. I feel like I want to spread the good word about some breakthroughs in Ed Wood appreciation that have happened over the last 10 or 15 years. You know, there are certain movies like Glenn or Glenda has been sort of reclaimed by queer and trans critics. And then there are a lot of other movies and writings, especially, that are available now that weren't available before. You know, his novels, his short stories, there have been several great short story collections. A movie like Take It Out and Trade, which was lost for a long time, is available now. And I think adds interesting new wrinkles to the story of Ed Wood's career. So I wanted to spread the word about all this. Do a sort of update on his critical reputation. So I think that's the thing that kind of I hung on to as the anchor through this.
I was going to say, I love that you begin towards at the start of the book. Also, just, you know, I'm paraphrasing you because I forgot where I put my quotes, so I apologize. But you basically are like,
room, Will, clean that room.
I know. I'm sorry.
Shots at older authors. We used to have venom on this show, Will.
I would love to hear which authors you don't like specifically. Let's go.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Yeah,
we'll save it for when you come to town. I'll tell you all. I'll give you my hit list. It'll be like Steve Buscemi and Billy Madison. I'll give you my hit list and the lipstick, and we can take them out while you're here.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, but I was going to say at the top, you kind of very, very clearly delineate where we're headed by saying, like, it doesn't even matter about reclaiming him as some secretly incredible filmmaker. That's boring, right? That's not what we need to do. It's not bad or good. We've gone past that. What we need to focus in on is, you know, that middle ground, something very different that isn't about arguing over, you know, you bring up Andrew Saris and his mistake of saying that a film must be technically sound, you know, to qualify to be a good film. And I just think it's, I think it's such a fresh way to come at this, to bring up all of that together in the soup and just say, let's just throw that all out. Get rid of the canonical, get rid of the deciding if we're fighting over bad or good, and just watch them with eyes like that and see what happens instead.
I do think the good and bad binary is a distraction, and it's a limiting way to think about not just film, but also art in general. I mean, you know, I love your guys in Chicago, Siskel and Ebert. You know, I'm sure they loom large for you in Chicago, probably. Oh,
yeah. They do.
Especially you guys. But you know, the thumbs up, thumbs down thing, you know, not the first person to say this, but it is limiting. And I think one of you mentioned Andy Milligan a little while ago, and he's another great example of someone where, like, yeah, it doesn't conform to any rules of how a movie is supposed to be made. And those movies are punishing at times, but like, they wouldn't actually be better if he made them better. That's the kind of ambiguity. Like, there's that great scene in Fleshpot on 42nd Street where the main character and Harry Reams like go into a cab on the way down to Staten Island, and Milligan's in the front with his camera. His camera's crooked, the actors are backlit, you can barely hear them. And it's like, would this be better if it wasn't like this? I don't think so.
No.
And so, yeah, I'm interested in, another one of the guiding principles was that a bad artist, quote unquote, can have things to teach us. And so that's more important than a label like good or bad.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I know Will is just very happy that we get to finally talk about Andy Milligan on the show for a second. They see that little smirk. It's been big, but we did it finally. Real quick, let's just chat, just a promo moment here. Let's, speaking of a filmmaker who did his own thing and got called a bad filmmaker for it, we've not brought him up a lot on the show, but Mr. Jess Franco, we have to just hit our dates real quick. And if, do you mind, Will, if we hit the
date? Oh, salute, please. Anything for Mr. Franco.
Okay, perfect. So New York, we're coming to you. July 12th, that'll be the first date of the Francomania tour there. We'll be at the Spectacle, and we are doing another marathon. It's not the 8-film marathon as last time. It's going to be a much more manageable, smaller marathon. So we got 4 this time, but we got the heat. We got the fucking heat, and we did some work on this one. So I think you'll all be very happy. Will especially is still struggling with one part of this. So what do we have?
So Midnight Heat, Paula,
Night of the Eagles,
Al Pereira and the Alligator Ladies.
Yeah, there we go. No, see, that's what would happen if John and I didn't do this together. If it was just me, that's what it would be.
And finally, the secret encore movie, Orson Welles' Don Quixote.
That's right.
Yeah. Just the battle scene from Chimes at Midnight.
Yeah.
Yes, we if we could, we would have played all of those. But instead, we have the Soledad Miranda Eugenie Desaad, the one that everyone has always asked us about. And I don't know where its life exists on the home video market, but we know we're going to be showing it. Okay. So that's going to kick it off. We're going to follow it with a film we all talked about last time on the show, Night Has a Thousand Desires.
Yes.
Ah, what a movie. What a movie. After that is Black Boots Leather Whip. I think one of his probably his best noir focused movie.
And one of his only genuinely sexy and heat filled movies. That shit is hot. And it's rare that a Franco movie is actually hot.
That's true.
You know, so I hear what you're saying, but anyway, I'm not going to continue that.
But we can come right back.
I'm just saying, whenever Lena Romay is on screen, I'm looking.
Oh, well, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I love when she's talking to me on screen, telling me to love her. I will.
That's right. Midnight party forever. But we're then going to finish the marathon It's something very special because we were chatting, and then we chatted with Liz Purcell, who's also doing this with us, and another screening while we're in town. And we were like, wait a minute, let's give him something real special at the spectacle. And we were like, oh, there's one movie of his that we know that is available that we never were able to see, because you can't see it unless you go to Spain and watch it at the Mercury Films Archive. And it is his pornographic film that Stephen Thrower says is his strongest hardcore film, called Las Chuponas. And so we hit up our buds at Mercury Films, and they were like, we actually have a 2K restoration of this. No one's ever asked.
Wow.
We spent a week sweating. Like, is that real? Is this going to be a joke?
Yep. And then
incredible.
Because we love you all so much, and as always, we'll do anything for Jess. We did say to Mercury, oh yeah, does that have subtitles? And they said, absolutely not. So today I completed the first 15 minutes of subtitling Las Chuponas.
It was going to be so talky. Who thought there'd be so much dialogue?
Well, it was a great moment to tell my wife, though, because I was like, hey, I'm going to shut my office door. Just because, you know, she'll come in and say hi while I'm working. And I'm like, you're going to see me going frame by frame through hardcore porn all day. So we'll just.
it's going to be
so awesome. I'm so glad that you've uncovered this. Just a question about or an observation, really, about Jess Franco's hardcore movies. How is it possible that the men never seem to get erect in those films?
Most of them are gay. That is why.
Yes. That's the biggest thing is that main actor. What's his name?
God damn it.
Lamas.
Failing.
Jose Lamas, right?
Yeah. Jose Lamas. That's
Jose
right.
Lamas. He was gay, but they put him in all those movies, and my man is struggling.
I will say, so far going through Las Chuponas, the dicks are hard. So I don't know whose it is.
All right.
Somebody's excited this time around, finally.
Someone's got
it. So glad to hear. Put me in.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine you being like, you're probably like the clapper guy, and you're like, why are you making this guy have sex with Lena?
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Get me in. Come on.
Well, we did, as we were going through, realize once we got through all many interviews and things, Lena and Antonio Mayans were talking about it, and the way they did almost all the pornos is they would be shooting a quote unquote regular movie they wanted to in the morning. And then on their lunch break, they would shoot a porno for a couple hours and then go back to the other. So they've all just eaten. They're probably farting. So even if they're willing to it, it's not the sexiest setup to, perform.
I will say the masterpiece there is Lulu's talking asshole. Those dicks just look tragic in that one.
Yeah. But the premise of the movie is so strong that you stay with it.
It's a pretty good movie. Yeah. So for everyone who thought we were going to do something like For the Babes, the Warm Milk, we're not. All of that. Most disgusting titles of all time. So yes, this movie is not available anywhere. There isn't even a Letterboxd entry for it. So
wow.
So that is going to be really cool. So please come to that. And then that's the 12th at Spectacle. 13th, we're taking a break because that's going to be a long, long night before that.
Yeah.
We're back on the 14th at the Roxy in New York, and we're going to be showing a little movie called Vampiros Lesbos.
That's true.
And another one called She Killed in Ecstasy.
And these are both the brand new, these are the world premieres of the 4K restorations. So,
yes, when I thought I was so tired of taking these around and watching those goddamn movies every time, it's like, well, we get to see the restoration. And Will and I have actually seen the restoration of Vampiros already, and it's pretty, it does make a difference. Those colors are popping. Okay. So
you can see more pubic hair, guaranteed.
I also noticed when we were doing that thing for it, I almost let it go there. I could tell that I could tell Soledad did not put, she didn't moisturize her elbows now in 4K.
They looked ouchy. Yeah.
Wow. Well, if you think there are flaws in the skincare of the people in She Killed in Ecstasy and Vampiros Lesbos, wait till you get to the 80s.
Whew. Yeah. You're going to see some moles no one's seen before.
That's right.
Okay. So after that, on the 15th, we're going to be at Nighthawk across town. We are going to be showing Venus and Furs, and we're going to be showing that in 35 millimeter.
Yes. Very excited. Wow. Yeah.
That is going to be really beautiful at Nighthawk on July 15th. And we are going to close it out on July 16th with Liz Purcell at the Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn. It's Brooklyn, right? Okay.
It's Brooklyn. And that's the Nighthawk in Williamsburg, the one the night before. Yeah. We got to get it right.
New York, you got too many fucking theaters the same night. July 16th, Draft House, we are showing in 35 millimeter. Oh, God. Lorna the Exorcist.
Can't believe it. In a print
that is, I think, only shown once.
I think so far, wow. Yeah. In
Philly. Can you see the single tear strolling down my cheek? I mean, that's so powerful to hear.
It's going to be.
Hey, that print lives in Philadelphia. Maybe it can make its way up to you guys for a show. You never know.
Man, okay. Well, I'll remember that. We showed at our screening series, the Important Cinema Club series, at a theater called The Fox, which is in a neighborhood where we have a lot of retirees and families. We showed Bloody Moon, which right. I know that will not impress you guys because that's a kind of entry level one, but we were also like, you know, the entry level Jess Franco movie is also the most extreme thing that's ever played at this theater. Yes. So, you know, we felt pretty good about that. I don't know.
Bloody Moon rocks. I could watch Bloody Moon.
Every day. I could watch that movie every day. That is it's a perfect movie. I mean, how did they respond to it?
Oh, everyone liked it. I think, I mean, you'll have to ask them, but my sense was that everyone liked it. It's a crowd pleaser. How can you not?
It's real, when that kid gets run over, if that doesn't bring the whole theater together.
Yeah, brought the house down. Yeah. I did give a trigger warning before about the snake that gets killed.
Well, we did. You know. We just said when you see a snake and if you see garden shears, just look away for a minute and then you'll be all right.
Yeah, I do feel animal cruelty is one thing that I will give the warning about. Yeah,
we do as well. We do as well for the animal stuff. Yeah.
That stuff does actually bother me. It's why it keeps me from loving the movie Wild Beasts. And I'm like, God, I want to.
It's so good, except for that part.
But you know, I can't. I hate that shit. But it is like, I'll give it there. It's funny. No one will do that for Deep Red, though. Somehow Deep
Red. No one cares when it's a newt.
That's true.
People don't mind if it's a little newt being stabbed through the head by a little girl and squirming. Everyone's like, okay.
Like fish in general, you don't see people do like the trigger warning before Old Boy, for instance.
It's true,
you know.
Yeah, well, we, and actually on that note, let me get that date pulled up here. We are going to be showing Bloody Moon also on July 8th at the Alamo Draft House, part of my Terror Tuesdays
That's next week.
Yeah. Bloody Moon's next week, so I'll edit this up real quick. It's almost sold out, so that'll be pretty cool. And we'll follow that with Zombie 5 Killing Birds.
Wow. Wonderful. A little bit of our old friend Joe.
Oh, Joe. We love Joe.
I've been going through forcing myself through his 90s digitally shot hardcore pornos.
God bless. I don't know if I'm ever going to get there, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't have a heart that brave.
I never say this, but I would recommend, no one does. Gotta say, it's really testing me. There's only one thing I've ever given up on so far in my movie journey. I gave up on the Amityville series to try to learn to love myself, which is good. But this is the second thing that I'm like, I don't know if I can complete this work, but I think I'll
are there
left. So,
well, you might as well at that point, but are there any, is there a diamond in the rough in Joe D'Amato's 90s porn stuff? Anything good?
Not that I've seen yet, but I will update you if I find one.
Have you seen his Marquis de Sade film with Rocco Siffredi? Is that one that you've got to? Yeah, not good. Because that's the only one that's kind of piqued my interest a little bit.
And it's not that interesting.
Yeah, what you just said about it is the end of the interesting.
Yeah. It's funny. I think there's record on this podcast of Will being like, I'm going to watch all those 90 ones. And I was like, I am not going to do that. And you're like, well, I will show you. I'm happy. I'm happy to see where this has resulted, even though I was hoping you would find one gem in there.
I think there's got to be one. There's got to be one.
It's too bad because, I mean, I don't especially like Porno Holocaust, but it's got the flavor, you know. It feels Joe.
I will say, now having gone as far as I did, I now my rating of Porno Holocaust has gone up immensely after watching what happened after.
That's good. Yeah. It's not all for naught then. I love that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever say that about Porno Holocaust, but I will say I've learned to love Erotic Nights of the Living Dead more. I've learned to just accept it's going to take
everything. That was pretty good. Yeah.
Well, it's good when the end lasts 30 minutes or 20 minutes.
All right.
Yeah, so. Yeah, kind of. But you know what? The last 20 minutes of that movie, not to get derailed on Erotic Nights of the Living Dead, but the last 20 minutes of that movie, I think, pop because of that first 100 minutes, which, you know, Mark Shannon, just an awful screen presence.
Those testicles.
One of the most wretched. I mean, it's legendary. Like, what's going on there? It's terrible. Like,
I would get a doctor to shave a little of that off just to see if there's something.
And did nobody on set notice? Like, how is that possible? How did his scene partners not say, I'm not performing with this guy? There's look at his balls.
I mean, they think there's a nipple on his ball and it keeps touching his thigh. I mean, that movie, I think we've pointed out why that movie is worth seeing by any newcomer. If you want to see the most horrendous, putrid set of nuts out there.
But like, they will they will confound you, though. Like, they belong in an oddities museum. Like, it's true. Like, I really do have questions. Like, because, you know, they're normal, like, ugly nuts. There are a lot of them. Most of them don't look great.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, they're
it's not the best part of the body, yeah.
Yeah, but that the pair that you're going to see if you watch that movie will haunt you. So give it a spin.
just while we're on Joe D'Amato's porn films, because I have no one else to talk about this to, you know, Porno Holocaust, there is in that movie, which it's been a long time since I've seen this movie, but there is a threesome scene in that movie with one of the regular Joe D'Amato porn actresses and like two black gentlemen that is so awful and unpleasant. They seem like they're having they all act like they're at gunpoint, which maybe they were. I don't know. And I just something I'll never be able to get scrubbed from my brain is the end of that scene, you know, after the money shot has been deposited, the look on all of their faces of just like shame and disgust. And I mean, I don't know. I actually think maybe that's the Joe D'Amato touch there. Like there's that anger in his films.
Well, there's that. There is definitely furious anger in those movies. Cause I mean, there's a lot of the 80s ones that I think are pretty good of the pornos.
I mean, I think he was a good filmmaker at times, you know, like obviously Death Smiles on a Murderer is great. Beyond the Darkness is great. A lot of them, honestly, even Emmanuel in America, I think is kind of good. Not just kind of good. Honestly, it is good. There's nothing else like it. Yeah.
Beautifully shot movie too. I mean, even like, it's like, and I like these two, but it's like, you can watch you can go through that beautiful Black Emmanuel set. You can watch all those Joe D'Amato ones. And if you really want to compare, toss the Bruno Mattei ones on side by side.
Yes.
Suddenly you'll see art where you didn't before.
Buddy Bruno.
Even though there's a lot to appreciate about Bruno, I'm not here to shit talk Bruno. I own
honestly, what was said earlier and what's said in the book about there are things to be learned from a bad artist. Bruno Mattei certainly often falls into that. And I think you said it the other day, John, you said something about like a trapped artist, no matter how deep it is, will always bubble up periodically or something like that. And like, that's what it's like watching a Matai movie. Cause every once in a while you're like, oh wait, what was that?
Well, also the fact that Matai was such a ripoff artist, you know, all of his movies are responding to some trend. Yeah. And you know, what he has to teach us is kind of like what, you know, what the ripoff version of those movies looked like at the time. Like if you were selling, you know, the bad Rambo or the bad Caligula clone to 100 different foreign markets who just wanted the goods, and you had a fraction of the resources of the original film, this is what the movie looks like. And yeah, they are kind of like the dream versions of those movies. And there's power and beauty to that.
I think we can always find that usually in those markets. Like, I feel like the Italians really, like, with stuff like that, they found those dreamy angles, whereas like Hong Kong, when they would reflect the American action movie, it was like, it's like, here's everything you ever wanted from an action movie that you're not getting, and we're just going to give you all of those kind of ephemeral touches.
Mm-hmm.
And I
absolutely.
And I think like Matei, like, so this is an interesting to kind of curve us back into our original topic. What is it about someone like Matei or D'Amato or Ed Wood or Jess, whoever, Doris Wishman, people who could do things sort of technically incompetently, but like find another avenue through that? Because rewatching Night of the Ghouls, and I know you mentioned this in your book, and we've talked about it with Franco a lot, so I don't want to go too nuts on it, but like our theory with Franco is David Lynch was watching a lot of these movies, and he probably wasn't a Franco fan. They weren't released under Franco's name when they came out, and he would have seen him at the drive-out. And so, but he's probably saw the other side of the mirror, because there's a lot of David Lynch iconography in that movie, like verbatim. And Night of the Ghouls, there's a couple shots in that. Like, there's a shot of some people. I think it's Officer Kelso or
Kelton, sir. Oh, it's Officer Kelton. How dare you?
That it really is fucked up, considering how much merch I own of them. Now, I wish I owned that Officer Kelton merch, but they're like, they had to go in a door, and then there's just another door highlighted behind them. But it, all I could think of was like, this looks like that. Sadly, the last thing Lynch ever made, the What Did Jack Do?
Like, well, I think Night of the Ghouls is kind of, you know, that's one of my favorite Ed Wood things, because it, like Lynch, it feels like a dream. The mansion in that movie that the whole thing takes place in is this strange, impossible space where you see it from the outside and it looks like a shack, basically. It looks like a, you know, barely a bungalow. And they get in and, you know, you're led through this strange dark hallway to whatever office space or recording studio that he rented for that night. And, you know, there's never any establishment of what the geography of this space is, because there was no set and there was no money to build sets. So Wood, you puts up a bunch of curtains and sort of makes an asset, I think, about the out of the disorienting quality of not having a set. Sorry, I forgot what your question was. I just went off on a riff, but Night of the Ghouls.
No, you're right on it, because it's those technical limitations that like lead to a new avenue about thinking of the image, because immediately I'm thinking like, wow, this is almost feels like proto-Italian. Like, this is making me think of like that scene where she gets chased in a lizard in a woman's skin by Fulci, and she just ends up in that huge dreamlike hall. Jess did it a million times. With here's this dinky location and suddenly I'm in this gigantic, you know, place. Do you find that there are filmmakers who have taken those imperfections to find a new path? Do you find value in looking at movies like that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't know how familiar you guys are with Matt Farley and Charlie Roxburgh, who make films out of New England. Yeah. Don't Let the River Beast Get You. Magic Spot. Oh, you saw Evil. Oh, right. Cause it played in Chicago a few days ago. Well, I mean, those guys.
Did it play at Music Box?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't even know. Cool.
I mean, I think those guys have sort of like made a statement out of the technical limitations. Like they've made movies that are sort of like, a lot of them are sort of like the movies you would make as a child, because you have a camcorder and the only actors you have available are your dad and your uncle. And, you know, they grew up and they still made movies with their dad and their uncle. And you know, implicitly, I don't think they would put it this way, but implicitly there's almost kind of a statement about like, okay, well, why not a movie with your dad and your uncle? Right. Like, yeah. Like why can't a movie like this be made here? There's a sort of element of media criticism to it as well. And a sort of poetry in the everyday. Yeah. And as to technical limitations, it's interesting thinking about Ed Wood, thinking about all these filmmakers like Andy Milligan or Doris Wishman, you realize that actually, you know, I'm not saying technical perfection never matters or doesn't matter, because there are movies where you can take great pleasure from technical perfection. You know, you can take great pleasure from Barry Lyndon and its technical perfection, or, I don't know, a Christopher Nolan movie, maybe, if you're into that. I mean, but
Lester Spielberg's usually, I'm like, all right, I should finally watch the BFG. And then it's like, okay, but Spielberg's always going to deliver on that front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like nobody is better at the craft of filmmaking than Spielberg. And there's a lot of pleasure to derive from that. But really, I think what matters is the internal coherence of what's on screen, you know, and really visions and the quality of the vision, the quality of the perspective is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, with Matt Farley and Charlie Roxburgh, Doris Wishman, Andy Milligan, I think these are people who consciously or not, the style becomes an extension of the themes of their films.
Yeah. Cause I've always looked at these movies like, I guess they're coined outsider art, but like, I think like, I mean, we do a lot of disservices in this country and film schools, but like, it is crazy that these things are like so not talked about, is like, how do you get started in making movies? How can you truly embrace those limitations? Because this is all lowbrow shit until, you know, if I think of a highbrow example, probably like Godard, when he made, I think it's Notre Musique, the one where he stages a battle in his backyard.
Oh yeah. Or, Film Socialism is kind of an amazing movie too. Like, you know, all of the different, you know, that movie, the fact that there are some scenes that are shot on like beautiful high res state-of-the-art digital cameras and other scenes that are cell phone video. And he's kind of finding the beauty in everything. And he just, you know, him and his crew were just on a boat, you know, shooting on the boat. There's an incredible radical gesture to that.
And there's a freeing, it just opens up, I think, possibilities in cinema. And I think obviously that's a dangerous road. If you're just like technical perfections, I don't know what I'm doing. The world is littered with those. But if you have that drive and care, and you, it's deep in your bones, you love movies like Ed Wood did, it's impossible for you to not create an arresting image, if even from time to time.
Yeah,
absolutely. And Jess Franco, I mean, how many movies by him have you seen that are in a hotel room or at that one seaside manor that he shot, you know, 10 movies at? And some of those hotel rooms are just like, you know, crap hotel rooms, but something about his gaze renders them strange. I think Ed Wood at his best does the same.
Yeah.
If film is a reflection of life, those are the most interesting. If I boil down to it, because it's like, you're choosing to see things without too much of the apparatus to take away from reality, but you're capturing it in a certain way. And I, mm-hmm. you know, he does that. Jess does that with so much. I think like we had just really praised Lorne of the Exorcist a while ago. There's a perfect example of like that movie. Clearly there is almost no budget on that thing. And yet it's become one of his most enduring films.
Mm-hmm. I just watched Pee Wee's Big Adventure again. Oh. They played it at a theater here, and it has to be Tim Burton's least expensive movie by a lot. And there are so many scenes in that movie where it just feels like a few brush strokes make it a completely different world. And if you compare that to Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children or one of the later ones, Dumbo or something, where he has all the money in the world and it's a much less distinctive world than what he creates in that movie, you know?
Yeah.
Just by having like in that movie or in obviously a more expensive movie, but Batman, both those movies have this odd mix of like, it's sort of the 50s and it's sort of the 80s. And having those two elements together is that's the vision. And that's so much more powerful than all of the technical bells and whistles of Dumbo 30 years later.
Well, I think it's too like a complete lack of whether intentional or inherent ironic detachment, right? Like, 'cause all these people that we're talking about, to their detriment and, you know, and to the positive, probably weren't capable of irony. You know, the shit is in their bones and their blood. And I think that even applies to, you know, the Moturn media stuff. That's why that shit works. Because in 2025, you can't do shit like they're doing without being seeped in exhausting self-referential, you know, ironic hell. And they are mm-hmm. still in league with these same filmmakers we're talking about, where they're like, no, we just, that's just how we see it. And so we're going to make it.
It's so important with those Moturn guys too, that they are like from the exact same milieu as all the people in their movies.
Yeah.
You know, there's no question of like power dynamics or anything like that.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, they're guys who are obviously like really smart and talented and funny and know what they're doing. But they're of the world they depict, and it's full of love. There's no sneering. There's no looking down on any of it. I'm just going to throw this out there. I haven't really thought about this, but isn't it interesting that like we're not talking about Tommy Wiseau the way that we talk about these people, who's sort of like I enjoy The Room as much as anybody, but it's interesting. There are certain filmmakers who have come along who are sort of like the new Ed Wood, some, you know, more interesting than others, but like Wiseau, who is sort of synonymous with bad movies now. I don't think it's the same. And it's not just because he only had one movie. It's because it doesn't have, because I think you really are kind of unambiguously laughing at him, you know?
Yes. I think that's an important point, and I only can blame film schools for this world that we are now living in. Having been through them, I have watched many of my former peers attempt things, maybe due to family money, go on to do them. It never coalesces. There's something that could be on a large scale lost about that intuitiveness. Maybe it's just that person out there hasn't had the chance yet in a sea of everything being, you know, we're flooded with so much independent stuff now. But the Wiseau stuff fuck annoys the hell out. It's just like, I don't care. I don't want to hear about the forks. I don't want to hear about, you know, it's like, I am not the, I don't know. I guess I enjoy laughing at a movie every now and then, but hate watching a movie is just never interested me. It seems
I only do it for Ari Aster. That's the only person I
fair enough.
I mean I do think The Room delivers. Like it's pretty funny, but it's funny because it's this madman who sort of took control of the cinematic apparatus, and there's an odd tension in the movie between him and the basically professional crew that he hired to surround him. So like the movie looks like a real movie sort of, because he got an actual cameraman and, you know, all these actual sort of Craigslist actors who, you know, can basically deliver performances, and he's this chaotic element in the middle of it. Yeah.
Felt like an experiment to me. And that's why I don't think we're going to see another one anytime soon. 'Cause it just feels like,
yeah.
Well, he made another movie. I have not seen it. It's just called Big Shark.
Yeah, I know. It played here, and I was busy that night. I couldn't make it out, which is a shame, because I wanted to see it. I saw the sitcom he made, The Neighbors, which, you know, Not very good. Problem is he's been infected by, I don't know if self-awareness is the right word, but he knows there's a joke, which is a problem. Yes. You know? Yes.
Well, it's like the obviously the person themselves and their standing in the world aside. It's like why Trapped in the Closet, the first round, was quite interesting and funny. And then as soon as he was in on the second one is one of the most intolerable things on earth.
The great.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Go there, but I like that.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
Well, let's round this out. Let's one final thing since we brought him up. How do you feel about Ed's portrayal in the Burton movie? Because I'm of two minds of that.
First of all, I love the Burton movie. Hugely watchable movie, beautifully made movie. And I think the thing I like most about it is that Burton pays Ed Wood the tribute of sort of synthesizing his style with Ed Wood's. And you don't see that in The Disaster Artist, crucially. No. I mean, if anything, The Disaster Artist is a worse looking movie than The Room, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. But in Burton's Ed Wood, from the opening credits, which are so beautiful too. Yeah. Just the whole general look of the film, it is kind of a tribute to Ed Wood. Now, I guess I have a certain ambivalence about, the end of it. I mean, I like the end, but it has the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood ending, right?
I like that you said that in the book, cause that's how I've always seen it, but I'd love to hear more on that.
The position of the movie is sort of who wants to watch the story of a bad artist who failed. And so it kind of, the way that it defends Ed Wood is by saying, love him or hate him, he got these movies made, which is more than you've ever done. And hey, he made a lot of friends along the way, and isn't that what life is all about? And I think all that is true and fair, because it's hard to reclaim Bride of the Monster as a good movie. but I think, or at least a good movie on certain terms.
I mean, that house kind of occupies that dreaminess we talked about when I think of
there's moments. Yeah.
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 Well, I think the way to reclaim it as a good movie or to reclaim it as art is to kind of pay tribute to him as an artist and to sort of take him seriously as an artist. And I think all of that involves reckoning with the latter half of his career, all the porn stuff, all the books, where, you know, a lot of people for a long time didn't want to hear this, but I think some of that stuff is more personal than Bride of the Monster is. You know, I think you can learn a lot about Ed Wood from Killer and Drag, Diary of a Transvestite Hooker, all those books.
No,
absolutely. And I love that you bring up only, like, when you talk about Only House in Town, especially too.
Have you seen it? Have you seen Only House in Town?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Good. I'd seen them a ways back in like very shitty versions, right? And I, you know, when Severin did their new release, I was very excited to sit back down. But the first time around when I saw them, I was like, cool, happy I watched them, you know, bigger piece of the puzzle, whatever. But I didn't think that much about it. But this time revisiting, I was like, this might be one of my favorites. You know, in the Ed Wood canon, I find it endlessly fascinating from top to bottom. And the, you know, and again, sorry, we can, it's compulsive with us obviously at this point, but with that, the Manson photograph and those periodic zooms into the shrubbery and that window and all of that, I was like, my man is cooking truly from his id on some Franco shit in this. And it's amazing. I think it's great.
Those zooms. I'm so glad you point out those zooms.
So because good.
Like it's clear what happened. This movie was not finished. It was supposed to have narration. It was probably supposed to have some other scenes. But obviously whoever was paying for the movie was like, good enough, let's put it out.
Yep.
But it being unfinished, I think makes it better, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It's probably the highlight of that hardwood set, I would say. Mm-hmm. Although I gotta say, I did really enjoy rewatching Necromance because I feel like I saw that on a shitty VHS back in the day, along with, I know I bought these off eBay. What's the one?
The Love Feast.
No, not the love feast. What's the one with the girl gang who kidnaps and rapes the guy?
Oh, the Violent Years?
The Violent Years.
That's
the one I was thinking of. Yeah. I just remember seeing those on the fuzziest possible qualities, you know, imaginable. And it's pretty cool with this new set to like, wow, I can, is that the Criswell coffin I see there? There it is. Those zooms at the owls, and it's like, wow, he had a Jess in it. Like, you can almost say that Jess wasn't the zoom happy one when you look at some of these Edgewood pornos.
I think he gets some atmosphere in Necromania for sure. I think he's got a certain haunted house vibe there. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the strangest way, it's, you know, and I love the kind of that, especially the angles of that one, because that completely makes me think of like being a kid shooting a movie, because it's like, clearly they couldn't show the inside of this couple walking into this house, which is what you'd want to show.
Yes.
But, you know, like, instead it's going to be them coming in, walking this hall, trying not to look at the like person's living room or whatever that's like right off side.
Oh, yeah. Damn. I wish I was still writing the book, because I would add a point now about how like his use of space in that movie is the same as his use of space in Night of the Ghouls.
It's true. Yeah,
it is. Well,
second edition, you can say now with.
Yeah. Second edition.
This is about to sell out. Okay. These are about to fly off the shelves. Okay. All right. So, Will, do you have anything you want to plug before we wrap up here?
Oh gosh. I do have a book out. It's called Ed Wood, Made in Hollywood, USA. I will tell you briefly about the release schedule of the book. If you go to the publisher or books, it is available from them now. It will be in stores in October to coincide with Ed Wood's birthday. And that includes Amazon, or Shamazon, as I like to call it, folks, as well as your local brick and mortar. And you may be wondering, it was originally announced for July or August. They delayed it to October. The reason for that, I'm very happy to say, is because the pre-orders are doing better than they expected, and so they want a little more time to promote it. Yes, thank you. We did it, everyone.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why, if you ordered from your local independent bookstore, that's why it's going to be a little late, and I apologize. It's good news for me. You know,
it's great news for you. Yeah. You are going to be going around to some places coming up here.
That's right. I'm going to be, hang on. Let me just see the Seattle.
This is how we do it too.
Don't worry.
It's on my calendar. That's right. Okay. So I'm going to be at the legendary Beacon Theater.
Yes.
In Seattle.
Love them.
We love the Beacon, don't we? On Friday, July 25th, I'll be there, helping introduce a double bill of Night of the Ghouls and Take It Out in Trade. For the real sickos.
Amazing.
And I was so thrilled. You know, it's like, I was like, well, we could show Plan 9 or whatever. And they were like, no, let's show Take It Out in Trade. And I was like, yes, my people.
That's what we'll give Tommy our love and that whole crew. Good ass people. Yeah.
And there will be some other dates of other things coming up. So please, I don't know, keep an eye on my socials. I promise I'll update.
And you might find yourself in Chicago this year, August 31st. We are working on it right now, but you're going to be...
Put it on your calendar, folks. It could happen. It could happen.
Yeah. Trust Fall.
And the Trust Fall is going to be Ed Wood's 8mm loops only. And I hope you guys are ready.
And we're locking the doors.
Yeah.
You can't get out.
Inglorious Bastard style. <You're off. laughs>
Yes. Or it'll just be like a live reading of the Only House book, just to see how long people take that. You probably don't want to say all those words out loud, though. It gets pretty rough.
I think the Only House book, that was the one, when I read that, I realized, oh man, like this goes so much deeper than I thought it did. Because anyway, there's one chapter in particular that is one of the most horrifying, obscene things I've ever read. And I thought, God damn, this man had a beast in him. Like, it made me, it was the one that more than anything else made me realize the second half of his career is not hack work. He's like, he's working through stuff.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, would recommend reading it if you're interested in that sort of thing, but strap in, because I myself hadn't read it until the recent reissue, and I was like, I'm going to sit down. This is going to be real fun. I'm just going to read some little smut, whatever. And then, yeah, I also got to that chapter, and I was like, oh, shit, okay. we're doing that now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not. Yeah, probably why the Burton movie ends the way it does, because Burton is filmed that second half. Boy, that would be a depressing movie. His death has to be one of the most depressing anecdotes ever. So we'll just.
That's true. But you know Wikipedia to look at. This book. So you all should get it.
Right. That's right. Will you have copies potentially for sale at your shows?
Yes. Yes, I will. I can promise that. So if you've already bought it, why not buy it again? You know,
get it for your girlfriend.
You can get it before your pre-order, and then when your pre-order comes through from the brick and mortar, you can give that to a friend.
I'll tell you, I've seen these stockings they hang over the fireplaces. That book could fit really nice in there coming up.
And also, wouldn't it be nice to have like one copy of the book and then also one that I've signed? So it's like that one. That one you put on the mantle, you know, you kind of put it in a little glass display. And then the other one's for reading.
Absolutely. I'm going to get a second one. I know we got sent promo copies. I love it. My cat put a nice hole right there. So I need another one. So we're going to have.
I'm so glad you have that, because I don't have the book yet.
What?
Like I'm told I have copies coming, and it's fine. I've read it. Like, I'm not going to read it again. Everyone else can have it. It's okay. But it's still, the book still feels entirely hypothetical to me right now.
Well, I'm proving it. I know this is an audio medium, but there it is. It's real.
Wow. Incredible.
I will say as well, at work the other night, I was reading it during a slow moment, and someone came in and straight up said, "How the fuck did you get that already? My pre-order just got delayed, and it was amazing."
Oh, well, tell them to order it from the publisher. But I'm so I'm so happy to hear that the book is bringing people together.
It is.
We're industry guys, you know. We get a quick look at this.
Yeah, we get it. We get it before the author, apparently.
All right, so there you go. Will, thanks for being here. We can't wait to see you out here, and the book's great.
Looks great.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm really glad we went on the Joe D'Amato riff too. I mean, that's the real color right there.
Well, listen, if we want to go deeper one day, I've always had the idea for the D'Amato meter.
Well, and by
the D'Amato meter,
or Rotten D'Amatoes, whatever the name is.
I like Rotten D'Amatoes.
I like the D'Amato meter, because that, you know, makes me think of the Screw magazine Peter meter, which is like, you know, that's understandable. It's understandable what that means. But where do things rank on the D'Amato curve? That's
an equal amount of beauty and disgust.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Hate and love, beauty and disgust.
Sure. All
wrapped together.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, until next time.
Yes, thanks for joining us, everybody. Go buy the book directly from the publisher so you too can get it right now.
Thank you.
Bye.